Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM.
Music too?
Honey, I live music. Morning, noon, a whole night. Everything else is just icing on the cake, you dig?
I dig.
This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. John Kelly here until 9 o'clock on this Sunday night special, the night we get someone else to come in and pick the tunes. And tonight, I'm very glad to say my guest is Jimmy Fay. Jimmy is the executive producer of the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. He was formerly associate artist and literary director of the Abbey Theatre, founder and artistic director of Bedrock Productions, with whom back in the day in 1995, he founded Dublin Fringe Festival. And we'll be talking to Jimmy about all his work and everything else. But first, Jimmy, welcome to the programme.
Thanks, John.
Great to have you here.
Thanks. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Jimmy, I reckon you might make a fine guest because once I was in your home interviewing your goodly wife, Amanda Coogan, the artist, and there were a pile of CDs there, very impressive pile of CDs, and she said, that's all Jimmy. So I thought we'd have to get Jimmy on the show sometime.
I hope I don't let you down.
Yeah, no, you won't. Now, first of all, Jimmy, where are you from?
Well, I currently live in Belfast, and so I lived there for the last 5 years. I was from Talla originally, but I lived in the city centre most of my life, Dublin city centre. And I was born in the Paw, Manitoba.
You were born where?
The Paw, Manitoba, northern Manitoba.
Were you really?
In Canada, yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
So in what circumstances were you born in Manitoba?
I think it was late 60s. My parents went over to, and the unemployment was still rife in Ireland. I think my dad needed to get a job. He became a probation officer in Northern Territories in Canada. And so we went over and I was born there and my sister Catherine was born there. And then they just realised it was way too cold and we came back when we were about 3 or 4.
Have you any memories of Manitoba?
I have memories because I've been back since and I've been to Alberta and I went back and worked in Alberta for a while. But I have distant memories of, you know, being really young and kind of with this dog in this big plains area in Canada. I have a tiny memory that I hold on to.
Does that make you Canadian? It does, doesn't it?
Sort of. Well,
if you need to be.
Yeah, if it's handy these times.
Your first choice, Jimmy, is what?
My first choice, I'm going for Riders in the Sky by Vaughan Monroe because it sort of reminds me of Canada and it's my... one of my dad's favourite songs, and I remember him singing along to it an awful lot in the 70s and stuff. It would be on the radio all the time, and I haven't heard it for ages, and I just thought, why not?
A ton of versions of this song.
It's the Vaughan Monroe one, though. Monroe. I mean, that's the one that I remember.
Okay.
An old cowpoke been riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw.
And that's Vaughan Monroe, Riders in the Sky, the first choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio tonight. Jimmy is currently executive producer of the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. He's done all sorts of theatre work, and we will talk about that. But you just mentioned, it's already news to me, this whole Canadian background I didn't know you had, Jimmy. Why did your parents go to Canada? I know why people emigrate, but what was the why Canada?
It was like the late 60s, and I think the original plan was for them to go to America, but Vietnam was raging then, and I think my dad knew people who had gone over and so they were recruited to the army or were drafted up, and they got a job, I think, with a missionary up north. Manitoba into the Paw, which is a tiny town and was a tiny town there and of only a few thousand people. It still is a tiny town. And my dad was interested in social work and probation officer, so like he landed a job there. So that's why they ended up there. I mean, they ended up there because also I think, you know, they had some involvement with the church that was there as well. So, and they lived there happily for 4 or 5 years, you know. But I think in the end, my mum just couldn't take the cold. I think it was just the whiteouts were just too white out, you know. It was just And it was so isolated as well, you know. But yeah, no, they went and it was just, it was, you know, in my head, it always was a mysterious place because obviously I don't remember it much. Like, I love Canada and I love Canadians and I love going back when we go back. And it's been a long time, actually. It's been about 10 years since I was back there. But it does feel like a different place. Like, it's very much a front, where they were in Nepal was very much a frontier town. Like, mm-hmm. there was literally nothing. Like, it was 300 miles north of Winnipeg. And the nearest town, I think, was like 100 miles away. Yeah. When I was about 19, I went back and I worked in Canada for a little bit. And I worked in northern Alberta. I worked in the gas station there and took road trips all over the place. And it's just vast amount of expense. You know, like, literally, there's only prairie land between Manitoba and you get to BC and then eventually you come to the Rockies and it's something else, you know.
What was that like when you went back at 19? It must be very strange to visit a place that you have very little memory of, mm-hmm. and yet it's the place you were born and you spent your first couple of years.
I've always felt, every time I come back to Canada, very at home there. You know, you get slagged because of your Irish accent and stuff like that. And these are small town places. I've rarely ever gone to the big cities like Vancouver or Edmonton and stuff like that. It would be like Valley View or Grand Prairie, Peace River, all this. And what's always brilliant is there's always a lot of time to drive and put music on it. So I went back there. I mean, some of them are, I mean, kind of conservative towns, and they would be very, I mean, in Valley View itself, there were 16 different churches, different faiths, just in the one population of 2,000 people. So there's all these different, there's also all these different cultures that come in. That is not what you get the impression of with North America. You get all like Ukrainian, you know, there's a lot of Native American population as well. Big part of being on the edge of society. This is what I found in Canada, particularly Northern Canada. And the strange thing is, when we did go to Tala, I think, you know, when, you know, my parents moved back to Dublin and they got a house in Tala. That was also like it was on a frontier town as well. It was It felt very much on the edge. And if you think about Tala, for years and years and years, there was nothing on it. Like, it's quite built up now. But there was, outside our house, there was literally fields for acres, you know, like, and rivers and stuff. And it's funny, I mean, because there was a river, you know, I grew up in a place called Tam Crescent, but my best friends were Cushnahan, which means beside the river. And we just played in fields and rivers then as well. And I get mixed up sometimes. I think of Tala sometimes as Canada, you know, that kind of strange kind of mix up because we were quite young.
Well, all this talk of Canada and romance and Cush Island as well, this Neil Young song that you're picking, Down by the River. Is Neil Young the sound of Canada to you? Because the thing is about Neil Young and Joni and so on, they did go to California. That's where they made the music.
Well, you know, you could argue that about some Irish writers who went to London, you know, just to make it. I think, you know, Canadian, I don't know that many Canadian singers who stayed in Canada. What I do know is I identified an awful lot with Neil Young because he was from Winnipeg, he was Manitoban. And the way he sang and the music that he has, particularly the early stuff with Crazy Horse and stuff. You know, the stuff maybe, the Squires, I think, was his Canadian band, and that was in the mid-60s. But by the time he moved to Crazy Horse, I think it had become kind of Californian. But I think he always holds that inside him. As far as I know, Neil Young still has a Canadian passport. He never took an American one. I saw that recently in something about Trump or whatever else. So Down by the River, like, it's a murder ballad, it's all that. But it has that kind of twangy guitar that I just associate very much with Neil Young. I'm very much with Canada.
Down by the River. Neil Young is a great favourite of Jimmy Fay, and Jimmy Fay is with me in studio tonight picking all the music. How do you feel about Neil Young and his 25-minute guitar solos? I kind of like him.
I mean, he can do no wrong in my view. Yeah. You know, I love everything he does.
And he does a lot of things.
He does a lot of things. You know? He does a lot of things.
So, Tala then. Mm-hmm. You were only three, so you had, you know, but you said earlier on that you kind of confused your the memory in your mind is slightly confused between Tala and Canada, you know, which was which. Mm-hmm. And we've had a few guests before actually from Tala who talked about that aspect of it being on the edge of town, really, and it being, you said, frontier.
Yeah.
What was it like to grow up in those days?
In those days, in the 70s, it was a fantastic place to grow up, actually, as a child for me, because I just remember getting out onto the streets, meeting friends, going down to the river, playing in the fields. There was a traveller camp over in the embankment. There used to be horses. Sometimes you get on the horses. I remember once being spooked because there was ruins around the place as well. They've all been bulldozed and were by the 1980s, where you could climb up and down. And there was a kid. He had a goat, you know. And I remember his whole thing was to bring us around and kind of let the kids kind of go. And I don't know where the adults were in all this. Like, we were just running wild, particularly during the summer. I remember swimming in the rivers and all that kind of stuff. And it's a bit of an idyllic memory, but it was good. But as time went on, there seemed to be a lot more drugs that came into these areas kind of in the 80s and stuff. And also, it was much more, like, in the 70s, I have a kind of idyllic process. But obviously, when I was in my teens, it was in the 80s, and you have, you know, in one sense, you've got Thatcherism going on, and you've got, like, whatever, Haughey and whatever's going on here. And you have a huge estate, the biggest population. It was a bigger population than Limerick, I think. I think it was one of the biggest growing populations, and there was very little resources. It was all before the square. Mm. There was H. Williams down in the village. That was about it. There was maybe a small kind of, shopping centre. There was three pubs, the Dragon Inn, Ahern's, which is still there, and somewhere else, I can't remember. And that was it. There was nothing else. There was nothing for kids. So, you know, my age group, which would have been the first kind of teenagers there en masse, were literally wandering. You know, and you'd be hanging in corners. It's
so
scary.
What's the scene in the Fay household then?
At home?
Yeah.
Oh, it's I have four younger sisters, all who kept me right, and I kept them right. And it was a very stimulating household in the sense that there was an awful lot going on. And my parents were always very concerned not for us to kind of fall into gangs or not that. I mean, you know, my dad's job is obviously as a probation officer. He had a very good and wise way of dealing with crime and kind of like, I mean, seeing how it goes. They believe in the local community.
He continued that work back in Tala, did he?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is where he came back. He went into the Department of Justice and worked there until the 90s. Actually, early 2000s, I think. And he, so they were aware of what's going on. I think they may have had a choice, as other people did, because I remember there was a kind of en masse, you know, where lots of people left Tala, like just left, people that we knew, they were just gone. Because they saw like the plans, and it just meant there was more housing coming in, there was more communities coming from, say, the inner city or whatever else into this area, and the whole place was just going to kind of combust at some stage, which it did. Like, the 80s was insane. There was like, joyriding was rife. There was a whole protest against where there was a travelling embankment, which was on the kind of motorway that's there. It's the dual carriageway was there. For years, there was hundreds and hundreds of caravans. And I remember my parents protesting against the protesters, saying, you know, I mean, this has to be sorted out a different way. And there was a whole standoff against people who thought, oh, they want them gone, and other people, like my parents, who were absolutely, you know, standing up for kind of human rights and that. And that made everything, if I remember the 80s in Tala, in any way, it was a very tense period. You know, I just remember it, like, it could have combusted in any way. Because I remember there was, like, I mean, there was, yeah, you know, it just, it was a tricky time.
What was the first music you heard in that house?
Well, now, the first music, the one that's have next, right? My mum gave me her portable record player that she had had since the 60s. And it was this big, heavy-ish, well, heavy, I could carry around, but it was a big wooden thing. And I just remember the smell of it. It was amazing. And the record she gave me was Nat King Cole, The World of Nat King Cole, which was this amazing record that I played over and over because I literally had no other records. And I just loved his voice. I still love his voice. I still think I hardly ever listen to Nat King Cole anymore, but I do think every time I hear him, my ears kind of prick up a little bit as well. So that kind of music was what was in the household.
And what song do you want?
We go with Love, L-O-V-E.
That's it.
L is for the way you look at me. O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore.
Nat King Cole and Love, L-O-V-E, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in the studio tonight. Jimmy is a very established theatre director and currently is executive producer at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Jimmy, just as we move into talking about that, where did the art first kind of come into your life? And I'm thinking specifically of home life at this stage.
Well, you know, I think our parents have a lot to say, because my sister is a fantastic costume designer, and I have another sister who's a brilliant producer in Lyric, and my other sister, I have to say, is a civil engineer, and another one is a solicitor. Okay, so they've all, you know, I think they've done great stuff. I think where the art came
apart from one of them.
I think where the art came from is basically just having very proactive parents who do bring you to art galleries, who do, you know, make you read books, who do kind of say, have a go at this or draw a picture or whatever else. And I think it's as simple as that. You can reject it or not. Now, one thing, a byproduct of that, is my mum also had to raise four sisters after I was born. And I would come home from school and I would be put in front of the TV. Not to watch Play School, but to watch all black and white films, like everything from Wuthering Heights with Laurence Olivier and Meryl Oberon, and to like The Third Man, to whatever else, you know. And I got all this black and white films. They used to show them on, I think, RTE or somewhere like in the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah. And I think I watched every single film I've ever seen.
You know, I wish they'd do that now. I spend the weekend looking for those films. I still suspect they're going to be on a Sunday afternoon, and they very rarely are.
Well, here, I don't know when Hitchcock died in 1980, but I knew who Hitchcock was at the age of 10, you know, because I'd seen his films.
Yeah.
And because they were on, you know, because you weren't watching them on VHS, you weren't watching them on any kind of DVD or anything.
And if they were on television, your parents would kind of hip you to them, because they'd say, oh, this is a good film.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. So that's exactly what would happen. And I think that stimulation went well. Also, where we lived as well, we had a little box room where I lived, like literally lived, and we used to take the mattress off and make sets out of cardboard, you know, that would come and, you know, that would have a washing machine or, you know, that kind of thing. We'd take the sets, make these out, and put plays on that would last for hours and hours and hours, you know, and we used to torture like in-laws, you know, bring them up. And that came, I think, from my dad's side. I think his brothers and sisters used to put plays on in Brighton Gardens in the 30s. And I remember Roddy Doyle, who's a good friend of mine, his mum used to go see these plays. And I think somehow we got that idea from them. And then on my mum's side, is my mum was from South Circular Road. And at one stage, Martin O'Coyne, you know, the great writer of Crane Lochiel, he came to stay. I think he was, you know, he'd been in internment and he had nowhere to stay. So my grandfather put him up, and he used to be in the top room of South Circular Road. And he used to listen to the girls, my mum and her sisters, play with the dolls downstairs and kind of made up this story about it. You know, it's like these voices and kind of a grave thing. And Brendan Behan used to come along and used to kind of like Patty to learn Irish. Or he met him in the camps or whatever else, you know. So there was all these stories were going on all the time, where you were talking about, you know, being, you know, like, I mean, these extraordinary writers who kind of somehow passed through my grandparents' place, and plays that were, you know, like plays were a great way of expressing yourself even at that time.
Were you a director at that time?
I was directing my sisters. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I didn't know what director was, but I was the one who...
Where does that come from? I understand people, kids. I wouldn't want to do it, but I understand kids wanting to be actors, for instance, you know, it's because it seems to be a natural progression. Kids are acting anyway when they're playing. And I understand other people who want to be actors because they're, I don't know, they're show-offs, or they want attention. Or I can think of a million possible reasons. But being a director, what do you think the impulse for that comes from?
At that time, now we're talking about when I was 10, 9, 10, 11, that kind of stage. And we probably were brought, like, it's funny, I met Jacinta White for the first time ever. She was an actress in The Gaiety. She was in Angela's Ashes recently. But I met her at, I used to go see her, or she was in the shows that Maureen Potter used to do.
Yeah.
And these were amazing pantos. So I think we saw those as kids, and we used to come back and just try and reenact them. The directing thing just came from doing it, you know. If you want to make it happen, you kind of have to do it yourself to an extent, because nobody else is going to magically come along and make it happen. Certainly is, like, suddenly somebody, you know, my sister... I had to act in these plays as well, but I always was uncomfortable being looked at.
Most kids have that in them. I mean, you play games.
Totally.
Maybe kids are different. We used to pretend we were cowboys, and we pretend we were Indians, and we pretend we were soldiers, and we pretend, you know, you pretend these things.
And you pretend you're
cowboys. And that's acting.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've watched them on TV, or there was loads of TV series. Back in the 70s, there was all these TV Western serials that were on, that actually Tarantino talks about, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
People used to complain about, you know, television is going to be the ruination of children and all that kind of stuff. I think now the fact that they don't watch television is doing them a lot of harm.
I don't want to, you see, again, you don't know, because, I mean, I think I think there is, what television was for us was a communal thing. You had to watch it together.
Yeah.
Do you know, that had to be, there was a sense of audience about it. Whereas what happens now is I think kids do go into like their phones and kind of disappear into the phones for a little bit. But I still think they go to school and talk about what they're, you know, what's going on.
But all those movies you're talking about that you saw when you were 10, they're not seeing those.
And, no, they're not.
And,
no.
You know, I mean, sometimes my kids will say to me, how do you know that? Like, it's the most ludicrous thing imaginable. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I sat down with loads of books. I picked it up off the telly.
Yeah, yeah.
From watching a nature program. That's how I know that's called a such and such, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
or
yeah.
From watching movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Mostly from watching movies.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I would be the same.
Yeah.
I mean, he is mostly watching movies or something on TV. But you would read as well. Like, I mean, I do remember reading quite a bit. And, like, I mean, that was part of it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I have a 12-year-old who seems to me very, you know, engaged and happy and spends too much time on the phone, but is also brilliant and kind of interacting. Like, I mean, his entire childhood was making up fantasy games with his cousins and stuff like that. And they would just go off and do this thing for hours. I mean, and yes, that begins to, you know, ease off a little bit when they hit 12, 13. But it did for us as well, if you think about it. You know, we weren't, you know, well, you and me didn't grow up together. But
yeah,
like,
but what happens is, well, maybe this will lead into your next track. Mm-hmm. Were you around 13 when music might have taken more of a firm hold?
The reason I picked this next track is because I did want to buy music, because as I said, I only had an Nat King Cole album. Mm. And we were in a sale of work, and I had a little bit of money, and I was about 10. I was 10. I actually know exactly what age I was because I remember the day I bought it. And it was December 1980. And it was like I bought the Beatles for sale. I just found it. It was 20p, maybe 40p, which, you know, whatever. Got it, bought it, brought it home. And Dad said, oh, I don't know that one. I remember we put it on, we listened to it, and it was fantastic. That night, John Lennon was shot dead. I always remember it. And because it made the whole thing slightly more heightened.
Sure.
You know?
And was your dad the kind of dad who would be into the Beatles or would give them a chance or would think this is sort of dirty rock and roll?
Yeah, my dad was only, like, I mean, if you think about it, like, he grew up with the Beatles. So, like, he was in his 20s and the 60s. And same with my mum as well. Now, they were never the biggest fan of them. They were more, I think, a slightly more 50s stuff and whatever else, you know. But they did like the Beatles. Now, there was no Beatles records in our house, from what I remember. And I think the reason I knew the Beatles at all was because Yellow Submarine had been on.
Yeah.
I think that was the reason. And certainly when I got this album, I was sort of disappointed. It wasn't like the Yellow Submarine or it wasn't slightly more, but I loved it. Like, actually, and I still love it, actually. I think it's a great, great album.
I'm a loser. I'm a loser. And I'm not what I appear to be. Of all the love I have won or have lost, there is one love I should never have crossed. She was a girl in a million, my friend.
Beatles, I'm a Loser, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio tonight. So you got that record on the day that John Lennon died?
The day before, that, the morning of, yeah. Yeah.
God. Okay.
And I mean, there's lots of songs on it, but that song particularly, I think, is there's something about that particular song, I think, where Lennon's been really true in a poppy sense. If you think about it, I think maybe been influenced by Dylan or whatever, but, you know, I've read up about that particular album. That kind of changed him a little bit as well, Beatles for Sale. And I think his thing with I'm a Loser is just going, you know what, I have all the success of everything else, but I'm still kind of losing out on something, you know? And I think that was his frustration all through the Beatles.
Mm. What music or musicians kind of became yours, your own one, your favourites, the ones that you kind of joined the gang as such?
Well, you see, there's a few. I think the musician that I discovered, not quite by myself, because there was a story to that as well, is I was on a double date with a friend of mine, Ray Morgan, who has since passed away, but he we were in a double date, we were out with Deirdre and Yvonne, these girls, and we go see Beverly Hills Cop 1 and Adelphi, and we were too early, and we went into Golden Discs on Liffey Street, if you remember, and he used to go there, and he said, oh, I really like this song, Lay Lady Lay, but I don't know about the album, which was Bob Dylan's Hard Rain. Now, I looked at the cover and I remember thinking, who's this heavy metal god? I didn't know anything about Dylan.
This is the live album we're talking about.
This is the live Hard Rain, which is still a really strange album. Anyway, Ray had a way of convincing me to do stuff I didn't want to do. And so basically he said, if I don't like this song, will you buy it from me? And I said, yes. So he bought it, didn't like the song, the version of the song. And he gave it to me and I put on and it was noise. It was just this, what is this, you know? But then he got to Stuck in Mobile Blues again, which is not the one I picked, by the way. But it, I just thought, that is amazing. And I just kept playing the album over and over and over. And I got into Dylan. And again, my dad kind of noticed this, and I was talking to Dylan. He said, like, I divide my life between pre-Bob Dylan and post-Bob Dylan. And I think I'm like a lot of people. It's just that Dylan means everything to me. He's just, he's the one artist I continuously always go back to. And in all aspects of his career, and even stuff that I didn't like, you know, years later, you know, I'll come back at it again. But anyway, I said it to my dad. I said, oh, I like Bob Dylan. And again, I was about 13 or 14. It was that kind of age. And he came back the next day or a couple of days later, and a friend of his in work, who was a Dylan junkie, gave him all these albums. There must have been about 20 of them, you know, and just placed them there, starting with Blood on the Tracks, all the way down into like Highway 61 Revisited, to a lot of bootlegs as well, if I remember it. I don't think have come out. And so I just started going through them one by one by one. And I became a complete Bobcat on that. And I think, again, back to TV, I think at that time, Pembroke's movie Don't Look Back was shown. Yeah. And that changed my life, because I suddenly saw this guy being really arrogant to authority. He wasn't playing the game. He was he was debating a journalist about his facts. Yeah. He was being conceited. He was completely kind of egotistical, but he was right, you know. He was saying what he says about truth is true in that documentary. Yeah. So my religion became Dylan after that. Like, Dylan is the only thing that has ever, as an artist, like, I love, you know, I like most things I hear. I like, there's no aspect of music I don't like. I go from techno to country to whatever. But Dylan, who you would argue is quite limited in, you know, in terms of his range, but not necessarily as a singer. I love him as a singer. But it's actually really deep. You know, there's like all these bootleg stuff that comes out, like the Self-Portrait one, the one that everybody hated, that bootleg, another Self-Portrait that came out. It's just profound. It's like so folk and so beautiful. His voice is more beautiful in that album than anything else.
He keeps on giving.
He still gives, like, even the ones I couldn't listen to with the recent ones was the those kind of Frank Sinatra covers. Yeah. I really didn't like them on CD. And I bought this record player for my son in New York. I'm just dropping that there because it just happened. It was a Peanuts one. It was Charlie Brown. And I brought it back from him, and he didn't know what that was. He didn't know what to make of it. He didn't know what CD was. But I started kind of bringing back albums or vinyl. And then I bought the Dylan stuff on vinyl. And then I put on vinyl, I mean, these recent kind of croony ones. And they make way more sense on vinyl than they do in CD or in digital form. It's just a different listening experience.
And there's some of the highlights of the live concerts now.
Yeah.
And it's also, I have a theory that it's, when he's singing those songs, that's as honest as he's ever been about himself, is singing those Frank Sinatra songs, you know?
Well, I think he's going back. I mean, I don't know. You see, the other thing is, I don't know anything about Dylan's private life whatsoever, but I presume somebody had a criticism, which I thought was quite valid, in some magazine or some article about music, which they said, why is Dylan doing all these? He's doing music before he reinvented music. Mm. I think it is partly what he's doing, like going back and doing all these kind of 50s crooners and stuff. Like, he completely changed the way we listen and how we listen to music, and, you know, and the types of music that was created, like, by fusing folk and blues and rock in a way. Now, he's not the first to do it, and he does it in a completely unique sense, you know. But if you look, and if you go all the way from the first Bob Dylan all the way up to, say, Nashville Skyline, there's a whole wealth of stuff that's right there. Mm. And Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 are kind of the two famous ones. But they are, like, they're amazing to give 16-year-olds or 15-year-olds those particular albums, because they do kind of, they're storytelling, but they're also amazing music. Was it the Tin Wild Mercury music? Is that it? It makes sense. You know?
And from all of that and all your very extensive listening and devotion to Bob Dylan, how do you pick one track?
Well, no, I mean, look, I mean,
what have you picked and why then?
I was going to just pick Bob Dylan tracks, okay, or stuff that was influenced. That's what I was going to do, because I just thought that was probably the most honest way to approach this. But I figured actually there was other things to talk about and stories as well. So I just went, I mean, this is probably my favorite album, which is Highway 61 Revisited. And actually, why I love From a Buick 6 is because I just love the language in it, and it was shorter. It was just put there, and the energy of it is something else.
I got this graveyard woman, you know, she keeps my kids, but my
from a Buick Six. Bob Dylan, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the tunes. Jimmy's the, at the minute, executive producer of the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. So I suppose we should move on a bit, Jimmy, and start talking about theatre. You did stage plays as a kid in Tala, in the house, in the room, and you directed them. Did you... How early did you start to think that theatre could be a job for you?
Because I got obsessed with Orson Welles when I was, again, about 14, probably about the same time I was obsessed with Bob Dylan. And again, it was from seeing The Third Man, you see that. And I had seen, I'd been very into Universal horror films like Dracula and Frankenstein. Yeah. They used to be on every summer. And then one summer, there was Citizen Kane was on, and I think it was the 40th anniversary of it. And I remember watching that and kind of like not liking it as much as Third Man, but really liking it. Mm. And then finding out more and more about Welles. And again, this was just, he died in 1985. And I think I came across Chimes at Midnight and I read up about him. And there was a biography published by Barbara Leeming just as he died that I got somehow. And when he died, I realised he'd start in the Gay Theatre. Mm-hmm. And with McLeamer and Edwards, who were also quite famous. They lived up the road from where my parents had been, or my mother had been. And she would talk about the Gay all the time. And I think... I hadn't been to the Gay at that stage. I don't think I'd been to many, apart from the Pantos, any kind of real theatre. But I remember thinking, I want to be Welles. I just want to be that person. Now, primarily now, I in no way got there, but it was about his directing aspect, the fact that he put it all together. So I remember, you know, like school, like, I mean, I just like, I had done quite well in school and then I hadn't done quite well in school. Like I had this bad acne and I was on drugs and my lips used to bleed onto my copybook and all this kind of stuff. And it was a horrendous time.
Drugs for the acne?
Yeah. You know, it was a particular thing that was just horrendous.
You thought we needed to clarify that for a minute.
Yeah, drugs for the acne. I wish it was drugs. Anyway, so that went, and so I ended up kind of going back to Canada and coming back and wanting to. I was in a course called Bolelli, where I met a whole lot of like-minded people who were just kind of doing theatre, and there was a guy ran it called Neville Carlyle Style. He was a South African director, and he was quite unusual and exotic and stuff like that, and he ran it like it was a theatre company, and I just remember kind of, this is kind of interesting. So I did that for a couple of years, and when I left there... I'd realised a couple of things. I was street smart enough to know that you could rent the International Bar for 15 quid a week. And if you put a play on there and you charge, because you could still charge 3 to 5 quid for the play. I mean, you were being profit after 3 or 4 sales. And the first play I directed was Accidental Death of an Anarchist by Dario Fo. And that packed out. That absolutely packed out. Rehearsed it in, you know, a bedsit that I shared with another actor. And got a bunch of actors in, and we did it, and we toured it actually, and we made not a lot of money.
It seems we must have missed something enormous from you, you know, at home listening to Bob Dylan, and the next thing you're putting a play on.
Yeah.
What happened in between times?
I don't know. Oh, in school, there was a couple of really good teachers, terrific teachers, English teachers and history teachers, and they put me in plays, like as an actor. Mm. And the way, there was one brilliant play called Manhattan Sour, which was like this murder mystery film noir kind of thing, where I played the chief of police, O'Flaherty, who was also the villain, and gets stabbed to death by the local kind of villainess. And it was in the Chinese Laundry. And it was like, there was loads of strobe lighting and all that kind of stuff. And I just remember, again, I was about 14, the electricity of that. The fun of that, you know, because I hadn't enjoyed school too much, or, you know, I'd been a good runner and I'd been a good swimmer, but the acne kind of took over from that. I kind of stopped when I was 14 being athletic for a while, and so something else had to fill that void. Yeah, so look, I went to Canada, I worked in a gas station, I came back, I wanted to do something, and so I joined this Bolelli school, which was in Liberties, and Neville was definitely the head honcho there, and he was kind of in that, you know, a terrific character and a director, and he talked an awful lot about directing. There was another guy called Neil Donnelly as well, who was very, very good as well. And from that, I could just see how you could assemble a show. I just could see it, you know, I could see, like, actually, all I have to do is pick a play, ask people to be in it, get them into the room, talk to them about the play. If they're on for it, great. If they're not on for it, they leave and get somebody else. And then put it on somewhere.
So far, though, those are the duties of a producer, really, aren't they?
Well, yeah, you have to be a producer sometimes, particularly in those early stages.
Yeah.
You know.
Let's talk about directing immediately after your next choice, which is what? Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, the Robert Johnson again comes from the Bob Dylan stuff, because once Dylan opened up a whole world, I remember going to Freebird. You know Freebird? It used to be on Grafton Street back in the day, and I think it's moved to several locations. Still there, actually. But and I remember going to Freebird, and that was a great place to hang out. And like for some reason, I don't know, I got recommended this album. You know, it was Rob Johnson. It was like a kind of reddish, rusty colour, and he was there. There was a kind of cartoon of him playing the blues. And I put it on, and I had no idea what this was either. But it's funny, if there's any way segueing this choice and my next choice together, that would make sense for me.
We'll do that.
Yeah.
You, I need you, I love you, Elvis Presley there, and before that, Hellhound on My Trail from Robert Johnson, the choices of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio tonight. So I take it the fact you wanted those two put together, Jimmy, that you really started to dig deep into American music and the roots of it and so on.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing about Hellhound is like that particularly affects me for some reason. I found it very difficult to come out of it. And one day I'd a mixtape that I'd probably made for somebody else but kept, and I'd had I Want You, the Elvis song, straight after it, and it just segued. It kind of, you go somewhere dark and mysterious with the Robert Johnson, and somehow Elvis helps you come out of it, and it's purely sensation. That's purely what that does for me. So every time I hear the Robert Johnson, I got to follow it more or less with the Elvis Presley, like every time.
No, I just assumed that it was as a result of you discovering this music and starting to dig into it and finding out.
Yeah. Because probably the first person you come around is Elvis, and then we says Elvis sang like a black man, and then you trying to discover who he did sing like. Now I have no idea if he was a big Robert Johnson fan. I don't think he was, but I think that era and what he brought, the light that he brought in reflection to say that late 30s, 40s, 50s stuff is really, really important. And I think like I'm a huge fan. Like I love Elvis to bits. I think he's absolutely brilliant. But I'm probably a bigger fan now of people like Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, you know, Lightning Hopkins, all those kind of guys.
Well, he was the gateway drug for a lot of people.
You know,
you hear Elvis and then you hear the rest of it.
Yeah, and also Elvis died in 77, and that was, again, a huge event in TV, if you remember. You know, the King of Rock and Roll is Dead. I was 8, you know, I remember watching that live, and the following summer BBC Two showed a whole lot of Elvis films. You know, I've never had to watch them again since because I've seen them all, you know, that whole summer from Love Me Tender to whatever the last one was.
Let's talk about the directing.
Yeah.
You'd figured out how to put on a play in a venue,
mm-hmm.
and you did that.
Mm-hmm.
What about the direction then? Can you just decide I'm a director and just start doing it?
Yeah, you can, because I think that's what Peter Brook says in one of his books, because obviously you read everything, you read like The Empty Space, and he was the one who says, you know, to be anything, you have to decide, I'm going to be this. And then you have to persuade people that that is what you are. And I think with directing, it was funny because, yes, my skill is probably as a good producer. I can put stuff together and get things on. But directing is a different skill. It is about you in the room collaborating with people, you know, trying to make things happen. Initially, you think, oh, everybody has to do my idea. But actually, as you realize, their ideas and your ideas together can actually grow something else, you know, and can actually be a bit more powerful. And having had a lot of experience now, I mean, we can talk about this in a moment, but like, certainly I probably didn't know what the hell I was doing. Who would initially? But I liked the fact that people weren't bumping into the furniture and that there was some sort of coherent pace to the story that we were telling. Mm. And with Anarchist, it was particularly good. I was working with a very close friend of mine, Alex Johnson, where we edited the script together and we wrote a lot of lines because there had been an Italian version and there had been a, you know, it had been translated into an English version, and we'd predict a particular thing. And so we'd work quite hard on it to make that happen. And out of that, we kind of set up a company. And then immediately fell out, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there was this girl called Debbie Leading who came along, who was this tall, statuesque English girl who said, oh, I want you to direct me in a play. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, ever, where somebody comes along and says, oh, I'd like you to do this. So I ended up working this whole company around Debbie, you know. She wanted to do East by Stephen Burkoff. And she said she had a company. She hadn't got a company, you know. It was like the stone and the soup, and we just built a whole company around her. And that kind of was the rest of my life for 18 years. Creating Bedrock was, you know, was like the very first hugely creative act I did. Because you
and Bedrock was a theatre company.
Yeah.
And who else was that? Was that you and her?
It was myself and Debbie, Pat Leach.
Yeah.
Declan Byrne, Alex Johnson. There's a bunch of people that eventually, I mean, because one thing, and David Mamet talks about this, when something is energetic, it attracts people. And what happened with Bedrock, where we got very lucky and we were smart, is one, we did a very good show, East. Lots of people came to see it. It was in the Theatre Bar. Then we moved to, not Andrews Lane, we moved to City Arts Centre, did Dr. Faustus. That wasn't so good. It was good. It was good fun. There was a good stage in it. And I remember I learned a lot about directing and that. It wasn't just about staging. You really had to kind of work a lot more with actors and about performance. Then we did Saved because we wanted to be a little bit, which is by Edward Bond, which is where the baby is stoned to death. It's quite a heavy play. But we brought that to Andrews Lane. And then eventually we end up in the Project Arts Centre. But what was lucky for us was the Ormond Multimedia Centre, which is now the Morrison Hotel, had a whole rake of rooms that are usually rented out to musicians and stuff, but mostly those places were lying idle. And I went in there, and again, the Orson Welles things worked well. I'd read about how he had started, and actually how he had started outside McLemore and Edwards was the New Deal, the Roosevelt thing. They did a whole project about putting actors and artists onto a scheme. And if you remember the early 90s, it was quite, I mean, there was a recession on and there was FOSS courses. So what we were able to do was put ourselves in a FOSS course so we didn't have to go and sign off or whatever else, and we could create a company. And they gave you money then to make shows. And even though they kind of wasn't education, we didn't do any of that. We did, you know, we did shows that we wanted to see and put on ourselves. And it was very successful. It wasn't the only thing. But it meant we had a company and we had an office and we had a place to rehearse, all free, you know. We were just able to get this brilliant site, which was the Ormond Multimedia Centre. And we were very, very lucky. I mean, at that time, I mean, poverty kind of worked. You took a vow of poverty. You weren't going to make any money. But it just meant you were working together all the time, like you were in a band. Like, you never stopped rehearsing.
Your next choice, Van. You'd have worked with him recently, actually, wasn't he? Didn't he play at the Lyric Theatre?
He played in the Lyric about 4 years ago.
That's a time flies, eh?
And, you know, we're hoping that he's going to play again soon, you know? I mean, just watch this space. And he's very much present in Belfast. Like, he is a, you know, he does his own thing and he's around and he does a lot of gigs, say, in different places. But I'm hoping that he comes back to Lyric soon. But the thing about this particular song is, yes, this is another one after, you know, in one way, my Trinity was like Dylan, Van Morrison, David Bowie. And the thing about Van Morrison and this particular track is this is the first, my sister was up in Letterkenny and I used to get the bus to go up and see her. She was doing a portfolio course in a art degree. And I used to get on the bus and put my headphones on and have this on like tape three times because it just, and then I'd rewind it again because I still think it's the most spiritual music I've ever heard in my life. It just is transcendental. And I've never seen them play this track live. But I've seen live loads of times and I think he's an extraordinary artist.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the dead
center
back road stop.
Astral Weeks from Van Morrison, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio. Jimmy's picking all the tunes tonight on the programme, and we'll be right back after this break. This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special. My guest tonight is Jimmy Fay. Jimmy's the executive producer at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, and we've been talking about his becoming a theatre director. And the one thing we haven't mentioned so far, Jimmy, we talked about the foundation of Bedrock, but we didn't talk about the beginnings of the Dublin Fringe. Mm-hmm. And that was you and your pals.
It was, yeah. Yeah.
What was the impetus behind setting up a Dublin Fringe?
Well, Bedrock, within 2 years, I think, had become really successful at what we were doing. Like, we were literally working as an ensemble. You know, there was more people joining us. We were able to kind of, we had these offices and stuff like that. And we just thought it was time to take the next step. And now, logically, the next step at that time was to go into the Dublin Theatre Festival, because that is where you were, you know, you got the exposure of, you know, international promoters and producers coming over to see your work. And we felt we were good enough for that. And we were going to do a production of The Skryker. Now, The Skryker is obviously, it's Carol Churchill. It's a fantastic play. It's a very odd play. And we just thought we could do a really good production of it. And we were rejected. We wrote to the Anglo-Irish, I think, Dublin Theatre Festival at that time. And they said no. And so we then thought, well, we're going to do it anyway. And, you know, we set about trying to find a venue for it. And in fairness, Fergus Linehan, who was the deputy director, and there's a bunch of great people working at Dublin Theatre Festival. Tony Erdalek was absolutely fantastic as well. Anyway, he said, look, why don't you and a couple of theatre companies get together and just do a kind of, you know, festival off the main festival? And I said, do you mean Fringe? He said, no, don't call it Fringe Festival, okay? And I thought, okay, so I wrote to a couple of companies like that I knew, all who thought this was beneath them, and they didn't want to be part of this. But I had got a taste for it, and so had Bedrock in general, and we got a taste. Like, I went around, I knew all these small, divey little places, like upstairs in the International Bar, the Theatre Bar up in Talbot Street, you know, the City Arts Centre, I don't think had been included much in the Dublin Theatre Festival. And I knew all these venues that we could get. They were just little pockets. And I just kind of wondered if I kind of put the word out, would it be people that would come along and do stuff? And then it began to develop a bit. And I mean, I remember Jack Gilligan from, who was the arts officer in Dublin Corporation, he put a little bit of money into it. Otherwise, it couldn't have happened. Like I think he gave us $5,000. Literally, that $5,000 paid for the brochure that we put together. Like, none of us, we were kind of on our own FOSS scheme anyway. But we went off and we kind of put the word out. And we just got this huge need for it. Like, I mean, it was basically, there was a need for it to create a fringe festival. There had to be a kind of independence outside what was seen as the main thrust of what theatre was about then. And I remember again, and he would not deny it, the arts editor of the Irish Times saying, I met him pre the event and he said, no, he doesn't think the fringe will work because Dublin is too small. And I remember thinking, like, I mean, we had a big programme and nobody had seen it yet. And there was a lot of people interested in doing it. And there's a lot of young, upcoming, dynamic directors, producers, actors, writers who wanted to be part of something or who wanted to express themselves. Mm. And, you know, we launched a program and it got very low kind of key response initially. But then when they could see the energy of it happening around the actual main festival. And what happened is the way we had programmed was clever enough as well. I would go for 6 o'clock slots or 1 o'clock slots, or whatever else, so that anybody who was coming over to see stuff would have a chance to see whatever the main event did. It would go see at 8 o'clock in the gate or the Abbey, whatever else. We could also get in a kind of 6 o'clock slot then. Now, you've got to remember, this wasn't happening before 95. And I remember I programmed, like, The Lion Tree Bower was the first big, big hit. That was Conor McPherson's, like, he was a voice that was definitely growing. And I remember seeing Conor's stuff in the International Bar and then the City Arts Centre with 10 other people in attendance. And The Lion Tree is there and it was packed and it just got a huge response. And, I mean, he kind of went, I mean, within 2 years, he was already in the West End with The Weir because he was so phenomenally talented. The following year, we put Disco Pigs, Cillian Murphy and Eileen Walsh, directed by Pat Kinnevan, you know, Enda Walsh's amazing play. And we put that in the International Bar at 6 p.m. There was queues around, like all the way from Wicklow Street, all the way down Grafton Street, just to get into it. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, it just took off. So the whole thing is, somebody was going to find this. There was gold, you know, like this was like oil waiting to be discovered. And it was just putting a framework around it and giving it some sort of dynamic or some sort of, putting out a calling card, but just giving it, you know, a structure where it could take place. And I knew I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to be a festival programmer. I thought that was taken away from what I wanted to do, which was directing and producing. But I knew I didn't want it just to end either. And it got too big anyway. Like, within a year, everybody could see, actually, this is essential. This has to happen. And so, Fergus very much came on board the following year. And it was, we were able to find more money. I think the Arts Council gave us our first grant, $10,000, you know. And we were able to kind of employ somebody. Ali Curran actually came on as the second director after that. And it just took off. And you can see it still. It is an absolute life force of its own, and it's really important for, particularly for young artists, to find their first step in a way of what can seem like a very mysterious place, you know, like trying to make a career.
Camille O'Sullivan would have been someone, part of the fringe, I would imagine.
I mean, Camille is like, I mean, such a gigantic star now. Like, I mean, she was playing piano, and the Dada Club was where we all hung out. It was a tiny little room. There was during the summer of 95. I remember going to it and checking out as a venue. And he had Jack L doing his, you know, songs with Jacques Brel, and he had Camille doing some stuff, and he had Susanna Dirksen, and he had the Nulas, and they were all doing these things. And I thought, actually, that'll be a great place for us to kind of base ourselves for a while. And we kind of moved in, and I remember the night of the last night of the Fringe Festival, when it was absolutely the hottest thing in the world. Like, it was like just an extraordinary night. Camille was playing Served by a Johnny. And I remember I was standing beside her, she was playing, and it was just like the hairs on the back of my neck. I remember thinking, her voice and what she can do and how she can perform is exceptional. Like, lots of people were brilliant. Lots of people were really good. Lots of people were energetic. But Camille was doing was otherworldly. Now, unfortunately, she's never recorded Served by a Johnny. I would love to hear that. I mean, because I haven't heard it since 95. I haven't heard her sing it since. But I love everything she does. And I think she's an exceptional live performance artist. She's really brilliant.
And this is Lady Grinning Soul, Camille O'Sullivan. Lady Grinning Soul, Camille O'Sullivan's version of that, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio picking all the music tonight. Jimmy, when you know, you talk about putting together a theatre company, putting together the Fringe Festival, all the rest of it, I'm very interested though in a director directing actors and how he or she goes about that. And I've heard different stories. I've never been in the thick of it, I don't know, but I've heard different stories that some are very dictatorial. Some are quite easygoing and they kind of let the actors do their thing and probably only pull them up when it's really not working or whatever the case may be. Do you have a general approach, or does it depend on who you're dealing with?
No, mine changes. Like, I've directed about 70 so productions, you know, between fringe, small shows like with Bedrock into main stage, Abbey shows into, you know, bigger things and some theatres as well. And the approach is about respect, you know. You've got to respect the artist that you're working with, you know. If you have a system and the system isn't working, and plenty of directors go in with systems, and particularly more and more so coming out of colleges, they have a particular way that they want to approach a text. They could call it actioning or objectives, whatever. And everything is slightly Stanislavski-based anyway. People want to get to the truth of it. They want to find out what their objectives are. I think the difference between, say, a theatre director and a film director, I think a film director has to capture a moment and has to find some way of making that moment happen in life, but they don't have to necessarily worry about that moment happening again. The thing about theatre is you're sort of a coach, in a sense that you want to get your theme all playing on the same pitch, and you want to make sure that they do more or less the same performance every single night. Yes, things can change, there's the ebbs and flows. And my basic approach is, like, I am probably a text-based director. That is probably where I come from. And everything has to come out of the text. It has to somehow exist within the character's world as the writer has imagined it, you know. If an actor comes on and you want to try something completely different, that could be brilliant, depending on the actor. It could be brilliant. And you have to kind of just be open to the liveness of everything that's happening, particularly in the rehearsal room. When I was younger, initially, I think I was quite open to anything happening. And then I became very dictatorial, you know, particularly in my late 20s and stuff, where I began to kind of action everything. Actioning is like finding a verb and, you know, making sure that your intention, you play your intention, and that the other actor doesn't need to know that intention, but responds to that and so forth. It was developed by some English directors, and there's great books about it, and you read about it and you think, oh, I've solved how to direct. But actually, as time goes on, you realise, yes, you need some sort of base knowledge of being able to talk, particularly to actors. Actors are really powerful in the room, and if actors decide that they don't want to do something, you have to kind of, you know, listen to what they want. Now, if it's something that you think is really important, you need to find a way, you know, be it by honesty or trickery, of asking them to do this thing, you know. You can't just let it go. And, you know, there's times when things come to loggerheads.
Well, you're saying the key is respect, right?
Yeah.
Well, what about if an actor is behaving in such a way that they don't really deserve a whole lot of respect? If they're acting the maggot.
At this stage, I just you know, it, you know, you just find a way of saying goodbye, you know?
Right.
Like, I mean, it's actually easier now because HR rules and stuff like that.
I'm sure it doesn't happen very often, though.
No, I mean, I've hardly ever come across it. I've never really come across it. I've had real strong arguments, particularly with actors my age, in a room, you know? But for the most part, like, I've had, it's about, you know, I remember directing, say, Tom Von Lawler, who was in three shows that we did. We sort of did a trilogy back to back. We did School for Scandal, Sheridan, which was a very restoration, very arch thing. Then we did Saved, which was this English kitchen sink, phenomenal play by Edward Bond from the early 60s. And then we ended it with the Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy. And it was brilliant. It was in the Abbey. It was a great time with Fiac and all that kind of stuff. And we did this, we had a really good language together about how to work. And I think the same thing happens with all actors. You work with them and you work with their instincts.
When you come up against, I mean, it's one thing working with your mates, working with your contemporaries.
Mm-hmm.
And working with people who are less experienced than you, mm-hmm. I guess. But to take an example of, you know, Ages of the Moon, Sam Shepard play with Stephen Ray, Sean McGinley. Mm-hmm. You directed that. Sam was here for the play in
mm-hmm.
Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went off, I guess, and you went with them.
Yeah.
You're dealing with Sam Shepard, who at that point, one of the world's leading living playwrights, without question in terms of reputation.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, and Stephen Ray, of course,
you know,
one of our great actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find yourself, even with all your experience, feeling a little bit, I'm slightly anxious about saying too much here or chipping in here when I, you know, these guys probably know what they're doing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. You do. Like, it's Sam Shepard, for Christ's sake. And it's Stephen Ray, who, you know, is a huge hero of mine. And I think the way he's approached his art and stuff like that is absolutely fantastic. But with Sam, like, I mean, God, Sam, you know, Sam had played with Dylan. He'd been on the Rolling Thunder, like, all this. I'd worked with writers before, like Edward Bond, kind of in a very good way, like in a proactive way, in a way where I involved them in a room and they came over. I'd worked with plenty of, like, new playwrights, but I'd never worked with someone like Sam Shepard. But the very first time I met him, we got on pretty well. And again, it was sort of based on music. Like, I mean, we talked about the song that he co-wrote with Dylan, Brownsville Girl and stuff. And he was talking to me, he got royalties that morning from it and stuff. And it was kind of funny. But his approach, like, I had also directed several, at least two Sam Shepard, maybe three Sam Shepard plays before, including True West, which I'd done with Declan Connell and Aidan Kelly in The Peacock. And I'd done it earlier in the
I'll never forget that one because I nearly got hit by a golf club.
Yeah, and we it was really combustive play, and those two actors were completely in.
They were still flying all around the theatre.
Yeah, they were fantastic. And it was very physical, and that was the whole point. It was to make it as physical and as dangerous as possible. So I came to Shepard's work knowing quite a lot about him. I'd read all the plays. I knew, I'd seen his films, all that kind of stuff. And I was terrified, you know. I just thought he would be, like, not a monster, because he didn't come across like that, but just going, what's going on here? And he had just directed Stephen Ray in Kicking a Dead Horse.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find out why he wasn't directing this. And I met him. I was, you know, the Abbey were great. I mean, I was flown over to New York. I remember sitting in a cafe with Sam, and he just threw me this kind of typed manuscript. And it just, he said, read that and let me know what you think. And it was Ages of the Moon. And it's a beautiful, slender, wonderful play, you know, for two actors sitting on a porch just talking about life. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, maybe a major work, but it was an absolutely brilliant, brilliant piece. And I still think it's a brilliant, brilliant piece. In the room, you've got to set up a room that's somewhat creative as best as you can, whether that involves kind of telling everybody what to do or standing back. Stephen would have his own opinions. Sean also would have his own opinions. But Sam, like, I mean, because I wasn't sure how I felt at the end of the first, you know, when we rehearsed that for 4 or 5 weeks and we were in a cold room, and I remember everybody was giving out about the cold room and stuff like that. But, you know, Sam was quite pleased the way he was going, and he would come in and have notes, and the notes would be always kind of amazing. He would say, like, the problem that we got to work out here, and I remember learning a lot from that. He would say, the situation that we have here and, you know, how are we going to resolve this moment here? And they were all very gentle, very simple notes in a way, but they all directed you towards a place. How are you going to solve the problem that you have immediately in front of you? Which is what putting the play is. It is a series of problems that you somehow have to make all work and connect and solve.
And he would sit at the back and laugh then when the play was on. He'd hear him enjoying the play himself, yeah, you know.
I mean, because, I mean, God, I was on that for about a year and a half, because that went from Peacock. Later on, it was in the Abbey. And then it was in the Atlantic in New York. And I remember in New York, you got 21 performances. You got 3 weeks of previews before it opens. And I'd never come across that, because usually you got two previews, have opening night, and you're gone, you know. But here, like, you're put up in New York, you're there for 3 or 4 weeks. They're doing what they've been doing for a year and a half, one way or the other. But he would sit back there every night and he would laugh, you know. Like, he liked. It's not that, I mean, he knew. He was a great artist.
Next musical choice, Jimmy.
Actually, the thing about Shepherd is he was a big jazz fan as well, and he would talk about different things. But actually, this one, Stella by Starlight, Miles Davis and John Coltrane at the best.
Davis, John Coltrane there as well, Stella by Starlight, the choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio. Just interesting, when you were talking while that was playing, Jimmy, and you talked about the fact that Miles Davis and, of course, Coltrane himself in a separate context, and a lot of those, they ran their own band.
Yeah, they ran.
You have an affinity with people who manage, who run things.
Yeah, I think it's one reason I really love jazz is because of people like Davis and Art Blakey and Charles Mingus and all that. They had their own band. They had to put these strong personalities. And if you want to know about directing, actually watch or listen to a jazz record, you know, because, for example, there you have Miles Davis. He starts that whole track down quite slow. And then Coltrane comes in and kind of speeds it up and kind of makes it a much more energized piece. And it ends with Bill Evans on piano. Now, obviously, they went on and made Kind of Blue. But I know Davis, and I mean, I haven't read biographies and stuff, and Coltrane didn't quite get on. I think Coltrane was on an awful lot of drugs, and Davis had become free, or you know, he was addiction free. And I think, you know, they didn't see eye to eye, but they were amazing together. Mm. And eventually, I think Coltrane had to get out from under that and set up his own band and kind of go off and form his own legendary kind of quartet, which is what he did. And then Davis went on and reinvented himself continuously, you know, eventually ends up at, you know, Ron Carter and Herbie Hancock and stuff, and then goes on and does the electric stuff. The same if you look at Art Blakey, and he does the Jazz Messengers. All the guys that play with him all became legends.
Yeah.
Like, you could listen to Art Blakey and Jazz Messengers over, say, 10 years, and you have three different sets of amazing musicians. They're all through that, you know, Lee Morgans and the Wayne Shorters and the Herbie Hancocks again, and the Freddie Hubbards and all these guys. Yeah. And they are just electric together, but they all somehow may have got dissatisfied being part of an ensemble and had to go and set up their own ensemble. And that's what happens in theatre as well. And I mean, I always think that we're kind of a small band like Bedrock was. And you move across, like, you know, you never really hold on to the same people all the time. I mean, there's new people coming in, all the thing. I was thinking about, you know, late Carl Shields as we were speaking just there. And Carl was like one of the Bedrock actors from, say, 98 to, he was in everything I did for about 5 years, you know. But eventually he wanted to be the showman. And he went off and formed his own thing and, you know, had huge success with that as well. Like, I mean, he was one really kind of, you know, okay, this is how you set up a company. That's great. I'm going to do my own. And that's where he goes and does and has huge success as well.
But then there must be a lot of actors who take the approach that, you know, this director is making me a much better actor, and they kind of are happy to comply with instruction. That sounds a bit severe, but it's almost like, tell me how to do this better, you know?
Well, I mean, the thing about actors in Ireland, I mean, the legendary actor in Ireland is Donald McCann, yeah, right? And I think the whole thing with Donald McCann, and if you talk to Joe Dowling, you think, I mean, it's not that they let him do his own thing. They obviously directed him. Like, the greatest performance I've ever seen in my life was Juno and the Paycock, Donald McCann and John Kavanagh arguing over a sausage, or rather there was a sausage on a frying pan, and they were both kind of talking about something else, but the whole thing was Johnny Kavanagh wanted to get that sausage and McCann ate it very slowly in front of him. Yeah. That's in the script, but the way they did it, I've never seen better. It was just absolutely electrifying. Now, that could have come from direction, but also that came from the two actors as well being completely in tune with each other. And I think that is also what direction is about, is to try and make everybody onto the same page and to work in the same place. But I think, yes, obviously, actors love when they get directed. there's nothing better, you know, particularly if they get direction that they really like. And I think that's something that maybe has been lacking over the years, that we don't have a culture of directors. If you think about it, when I hit 40, I remember thinking, who's ahead of me here, right? There's obviously Gary Hines, who's brilliant. There's Lynn Parker, all brilliant. Joe Dowling, Patrick Mason, Colin Morrison, just slightly older than me. But actually, directing is a lemming's career. You hit 40 and everybody goes off the cliff. There's always tons of directors, particularly, you know, the young ones coming up in the mid-20s, you know. But by the time they actually have to, you know, sort of settle down or something like that, it's a very difficult profession, you know. Now, I hope that's changing, because I would hope, like even in the lyric and stuff, you're trying to give opportunities to not just young directors, but, you know, professional career directors, because it has been lacking. There was very few in the 80s and stuff before that.
Because your title now is executive producer.
Yeah, but I'm like the artistic director, executive producer. And yeah. I think, you know, and I'll just save time by saying executive producer, because that makes you seem in charge, you know. It's like... But officially, I'm the artistic director of the lyric and I'm the executive producer. Like, I don't have a chief executive or whatever else, because I feel, and, you know, the lyric feels as well, like it is better to be artistic led rather than commerce led. It means you have to be wide open. Like, I mean, I do have the shows that sell, you know, because basically we get a fraction of, say, what the Abbey gets, you know, in terms of a grant. I know it's a different territory and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, we're going to make a big building that has two spaces.
We'll talk about the lyric job after your next musical choice, which is what? We're not going to get through everything on this list at this point, so you start to get a little bit more choosy here.
Well, we talked about Art Blakey, and, I mean, for those who haven't heard him in the Jazz Messengers, what about Alamode?
Blakey there and Alamode, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. The choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in the studio tonight picking all the tracks. Jimmy, we talked earlier about Bedrock and, you know, working with the Abbey and taking the Sam Shepard play further afield and so on and so forth. You're currently in Belfast and you have been for quite a number of years now. How long have you been in Belfast?
I've been there 5.5 years nearly.
And your full title, well, you're as executive producer,
artistic director, executive producer, yeah.
At the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Was it a big decision to go to Belfast for you?
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, I had worked in Belfast a couple of times over the previous two decades. I'd worked with Tinderbox on an amazing play by Owen McCafferty, adaptation of Ionesco's The Chairs. And I had also worked in Convictions. I was the only certain director who worked in Convictions in the Crumlin Road jailhouse, again for Tinderbox. And it was an extraordinary event where basically you got into Crumlin Road and writers responded and directors responded to that site that, you know, is still closed down, by the way. I go down there and it's a complete shack, so you can't even get there anymore. And that was an electrifying. I remember the first time I went down the Shankill Road, the first time I was in the Falls. I mean, it was a really amazing experience, and that was about 99, 2000. I directed once before at the Lyric with the True West. So when that job came up, you know, funding had kind of dried up down south for independent companies, not just my company, but for an awful lot of companies. And it was tough. And I was always interested in running a venue. I wanted to see what that was like as opposed to just a company. And I felt I'd had experience years ago. I'd worked in a classic cinema. I'd seen, you know, how to manage.
Yeah, but you were a kid, weren't you?
Well, I was 16 to 20, yeah. About that age. And then I'd worked in the Abbey as a staff director and associate artist, etc. And, you know, it's, I'd seen how Fiac on about it. I'd also seen how Patrick Mason had, you know, been an artistic director as well. And I felt like I was sort of ready to run a building. And the Lyric job came up and I threw my hat in and I was very lucky and, you know, privileged to get that position. But I didn't know anything about Belfast. I didn't really know anything about the artistic scene there. And so that was a matter of discovering what was going on and was there more to it than what you usually think is there? Was the younger artists coming up? Was there directors who actually existed?
Was it better than you thought or worse than you feared?
Oh, no, no, it was fundamentally better than I thought. But again, it's about providing opportunity.
Yeah.
One thing I was really happy about was that instead of directing every show, because you're the artistic director and you think, OK, I can do anything I want now, I was really happy to find other directors to kind of, I was able to direct the building. That's what I felt.
Yeah.
That I was able to kind of somehow, I mean, program, which I had loved doing with the Fringe Festival, and work it that way, and also to find directors, young and old, who would come in and kind of direct a piece. And like, for example, one of the really brilliant directors who had never worked in the Lyric before, even though she had her own company, Prime Cut, was Emma Jordan.
Yeah.
And Emma directed for me a Belfast version of Educating Rita, which I had the rights to, by the way. I mean, this was one of the commercial things I brought into the Lyric. And Oisin Kearney, who's a young upcoming playwright, he adapted it. And it's a really good piece of work. Like, it's a brilliant play anyway. But what they were able to do with it and how they were able to kind of Norden it or Belfast it, well, it's brilliant. And that really took off. And Emma, like, I mean, had a really great time. And so she brought, we did a co-production with Prime Cut of Red, which is a phenomenal play about the artist Rothko and stuff. And that won a hell of a lot of awards and stuff in the Irish Times.
See, when you talk about a play about Rothko and all the rest of it,
yeah.
I think the impression might be that if you go to work at the Lyric, every play has to be about, I don't know, paramilitaries, or it has to be about Narn Éireann or something, or Terry Hooley. And in fact, there is one about Terry Hooley.
There is, and we'll talk about so, that.
But you know what I mean? That it has to be ferociously local.
No, it doesn't at all. Like, actually, if you did any plays about the Troubles, I did Pentecost by Stuart Parker, which is a great...
That's where I saw it, actually, the first time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I loved that play, and it was brilliant. But when I did it there, I remember somebody saying to me, oh, that's, you know, the kind of play that people think people from here want to see.
Yeah.
They don't want to see that.
Yeah.
They want to see exactly what somebody in Dublin wants to see. They want to see entertaining, for the most part, you know, provocative, interesting pieces of theatre. They don't necessarily want to see a play that deals with a conflict from 20 years ago and stuff, even though that is very important that people do deal with that in an artistic way. And it does simmer under there all the time. But it's not that, you know, like, I mean, if I was just to program Troubles plays, we'd be closed by now. You know, you have to find a variety. And I find that very interesting as well. And even if you look, like, at any kind of, like, I mean, theatre that is surviving on its box office, you know, because, I mean, the Lyric is a combination of the Arts Council and its box office. It's almost equal, and both halves, and a little bit of philanthropy as well. You know, you have to get 300 people almost every night through the doors to see a piece of work, okay? That is a lot of people in a town the size of Belfast. So you do have to have a slightly broader thing. Now, there is, what's brilliant about the Lyric is a smaller studio, and you can experiment in there, and you can try new pieces of work out, and you can do all that kind of stuff as well.
So has it been a good experience for you creatively?
I've loved it. I love it. I actually genuinely love it. It is like running a company again. It's like having a big brass band, you know. It's like being Charlie Mingus or Duke Ellington. And the people I work with are fantastic. I have an amazing team that works really well together as a collective, and that's important, actually.
Okay, time for two more pieces of music. This is the second last choice, and Lisa O'Neill. I mean, I think Lisa is just, she's the real thing as far as I'm concerned. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, no, I think, I mean, I remember, I mean, she, weirdly, she was our neighbour in Dublin. You know, Amanda and I, we live in Arbor Hill, and Lisa was renting a room in the house next door, and it was, so we used to go see her gigs, and I remember going and saying, anything, this tiny creature with this huge voice that is like nothing else I've ever heard. And but she gets it all. Like, I mean, she is that folk blues authentic thing that is slightly, I mean, just ever so slightly harsh, but beautiful. Like, really, I mean, what I love about her, I genuinely love her as an artist. She reaches right into your soul and kind of grabs it, and she's a really interesting way of writing her songs as well, which I think is, you know, she's a superb artist.
On my way to heaven, pothole in the sky, spell your destination, he summoned me to try. Falling for the devil.
And that's Lisa O'Neill, Pothole in the Sky. Choice of Jimmy Fay, who's with me in studio tonight picking all the tunes. Jimmy, I said at the top of the programme that one of the reasons I figured you'd be a most excellent guest on the programme was that when I went up to Belfast to interview your wife, Amanda Coogan, performance artist and many other things besides, I noticed all these CDs in the room. I've asked this of other people before who happen to be married to somebody else who's vaguely in the same business. What's the dynamic there when you've got, you know, yourself and Amanda? She's, God knows where her head is all the time, thinking about her next big project, and you must be something similar. So when it comes to making sandwiches and getting the kids out and all that, I mean, how does that work?
Well, that does work. I mean, she is a force of nature. There's no two ways about Amanda. And it is like being married to a whirlwind sometimes, you know, because sometimes when she's very busy, she's in and out of the house and she's all over Europe and she's working with, you know, Marina Abramovich somewhere or whatever else, and she's gone. And then she's back and she's very much back. And she's, you know, she'll start little things in the house, you know, like, I mean, there'll be new rooms appearing because she's able to, she's a sculptor. She's able to kind of take down walls and recreate other walls. So she never stops. Her energy is phenomenal. And that can be kind of, oh my God, can we just sit down and whatever. But she is just a force of nature, and it's an absolutely amazing thing to be married to her. And she's brilliant. Like, she's an amazing mom as well. Like, I mean, you know, she's just very entertaining, very there, you know, very present. And in terms of being two creatives, I think we decided early on that we wouldn't work together. And I mean, I think sometimes we miss it. It'd be nice to kind of do something together. But also, I think it saved our marriage. I mean, I think quite often, you know, we're a very good partnership for each other. I think we understand each other. And I can be away quite a bit as well. And particularly when I wasn't in the Lyric, I would be away quite often. I could be away 5-6 weeks.
Even when you're at home, you're not away as well, because you must be thinking all the time about the production that you've got to.
But that's why I think it's good to be with somebody who's creative. You know, again, at the base of everything is respect. You have to respect for each other's processes. And I, at this stage, understand Amanda's process, and if she needs to go out and create something, that's what she needs to do. And the same with me. I mean, she gets this now in terms of, like, you know, like, the theatre is a big part of our life. You know, the Lyric is, everything is formed around it to a certain extent. I mean, you know, a theatre isn't any good unless it is part of the community, and you have to make, you know, a theatre not an exclusive place but an inclusive place.
All right. Before you go, what... Now, Lyric is also a touring company as well. I mean,
yes.
you tour and,
yeah.
and you're in Dublin.
Yeah, currently we are in Dublin with a play by the Western World, which is a co-production that we're doing at Dublin Theatre Festival. We also have, which is a brilliant production that's happening now. The director, Una Murphy, has set it kind of Norden and Donegal and stuff, and it's got a really fantastic cast. Charlie Bonner, Frankie McCafferty, Joe Donnelly, some really new people who are just absolutely brilliant. So that's in the Gaiety for the coming week. And we also have an association production of The Alternative by Usheen Kearney and Michael Patrick, which is a Fish Amble production, but we did a lot to help create that show. I mean, the two writers work with us and with our literary department, and that is touring all over the place. But that is about an imagined Ireland that got home rule in 1916, mm-hmm. but didn't go through the War of Independence and all that. And it's like now there's a kind of air exit happening from Britain. There's a whole vote going on. I haven't actually seen the finished production, but the script is fantastic.
I'm glad this subject only came up now and we have no time to get any further into it.
No, we're not talking about that.
The play sounds good, but the reality I want to avoid.
We also have a brilliant production called Good Vibrations, based on a film based on Terry Hooley's life, which is a really good, you know, it's a really phenomenal piece of work, I think, directed by Des Kennedy.
That was on before, wasn't it? That was on a while
ago. We did that, but we're hoping to bring it back. We will bring it back in May, June this year, and I want to bring it down to Dublin because I think people would love it. I genuinely, it's like, it also shows Belfast and the North in a completely new light. It is about creativity. It is about that punk scene in the late 70s, early 80s. It is based on a film, but it also feels like a live gig. And anybody who saw it just fell in love with it. You know, it is a phenomenal piece of work, I think.
Jimmy, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you, John. Thank
Jimmy
you.
Jimmy Fay. Your last choice, Jimmy. Sorry, I forgot. Your last choice, Jimmy, is what?
Planxty, Raggle Taggle Gypsy.
And then the wonderful moment when it goes into Tour Dun Dun.
You need to do that because actually Amanda and me were travelling around in cars and we just have this on all the time. It's an amazing piece of work.
Jimmy Fay, thanks very much.
There were three owl gypsies came to our hall door. They came brave and bold, he-o, and this one sang hoy, and the other sang la-ho, and the lady sang the raggle-taggle gypsy, he-o. It was upstairs and downstairs the lady he went, but on her suit of leather, oh, it was the cry all around her door. She's away with the raggle-taggle gypsy, he-o.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.